We are back, and judging by the music, you know that what we're going to do at this point is the good, the bad, and the ugly. Let's do a little detour, Miss Miller. What do you say?
I say yes.
Let's do two of each, dating back over the last 2 weeks, during which time it was a good week for Jimmy Carter, who celebrated his 100th birthday, becoming the first former U.S. president to hit that milestone. Carter entered hospice care about a year ago with cancer of the brain and liver, and is reportedly very much looking forward to voting for Harris. And you know, he lives in the swing state of Georgia, so it could help. It was also a good week, I think it's fair to say, for the zero-tolerance mentality, with the news that an elementary school, and this one's in Georgia, suspended a 9-year-old girl for pretending that a banana was a gun. The girl's father, Ryan Jashmowitz, said he believes several students were using the nanas as guns at lunch when his daughter picked up her banana and said, "Pew, pew, you're under arrest." Jashmowitz said he initially laughed when school officials told him his daughter earned a one-day suspension. But he said they weren't laughing back. It was, on the other hand, a bad week for, I guess you'd say, full disclosure, with the news that a Florida man is suing his real estate broker for failing to disclose that the person buying the house was Jeff Bezos. Toy magnate Leo Chris said if he'd known the billionaire Amazon founder was the prospective buyer of his Miami mansion, he never would have agreed to lower its price from $85 million to $79 million. The broker should pay Chris $6 million, his complaint states, for not passing along, quote, "this very important fact," unquote. Meanwhile, out here in California, it was a bad week for Toucan Sam after our governor, Gavin Newsom, signed a law that bans public schools from serving the food dyes that color Fruit Loops and other brightly hued processed foods. These additives have been linked to hyperactivity. By RFK Jr. probably, and other behavioral problems. Probably also from RFK Jr. And lastly, it was an ugly week in the last couple of weeks for authenticity after the Ohio Renaissance Festival, described as a whimsical recreation of life in the electric-free 16th century Europe, well, announced it was closing for a day due to a power outage. And it was a really ugly week, I think you'd have to say, for social distancing, at least in the past, when Dr. Jay Varna, New York City's former COVID czar, did admit to hosting sex parties and to attending a packed underground rave at the height of the pandemic. Said Varna, "I take responsibility for not using the best judgment." Well, Mr. Millen, I would say that the theme of not using the best judgment would serve admirably what we're going to talk about for the next 20 minutes.
I think so.
All right, let's move back into that topic of sane washing, which has sort of dominated the last few programs. It's a real concept that the mainstream media, the corporate media, is going pretty easy on Trump's ramblings, admittedly. It is a complicating factor to decide when a pathological liar is showing cognitive decline, because you can't rely on the usual guide of people saying things that are crazy and not true. But anyway, I guess in last Sunday's paper, the New York Times finally noticed something was amiss. Dave Pakman was on the topic, and let's hear from Dave.
Welcome to the show, everybody. We have a huge week ahead of us. All of a sudden, after years of obvious deterioration, the New York Times has suddenly discovered the reality of Donald Trump's cognitive decline just weeks before the 2024 presidential election. Well, good for them. They finally stumbled across this major multi-year story. They finally figured it out and decided, hey, we might want to report on this, given that this guy might be within tens of thousands of votes of the presidency or might even be president again. In a new piece titled "Trump Speeches Increasingly Angry and Rambling Reignite the Question of Age," the New York Times subheadline reads, "With the passage of time, the 78-year-old former president's speeches have grown darker, harsher, longer, angrier, less focused, more profane, and increasingly fixated on the past, according to a review of his public appearances over the years. Now, you'll notice, because you, I'm sure, have been following the story as we have for years, you'll notice that when you read the New York Times article, there is nothing new or newsworthy. It's been happening for years. What's new is that the New York Times has decided, hey, there's days left until the election. Maybe we'll talk about this. Criticism of Trump's mental fitness is obviously not new, but the New York Times has discovered Trump's cognitive decline only after Joe Biden was pressured out of the race and after spending much time talking about Joe Biden in this context. And now, as the election is close, the New York Times suddenly chooses to highlight Donald Trump's age-related issues. Is it a strategic move? I don't know. We'll talk about it. But even though the New York Times is covering it, they're covering it in arguably a much softer way than they should be. The New York Times is presenting this Trump stuff as a recent phenomenon, sort of framing it in terms of age rather than acknowledging the long-standing behaviors that Trump's been exhibiting along these lines for years. And, you know, in some ways, the New York Times article isn't bad. Like, for example, it includes a data analysis which shows Trump's speeches have become longer, filled with more negative, kind of black and white, all or nothing language. That's very interesting to include. The problem I have with the New York Times piece, other than being too little too late, is that their critique points out that such language is now present in Trump's speeches, but it ignores that it's been present for years. And so that's why the timing of this is raising some questions for me. The New York Times article emphasizes the increased profanity and anger in Trump's speeches, sort of that his rhetorical style is getting darker and darker. And it is getting darker, but critics like me and others have realized this has actually been going on. It's been dark since 2016. I mean, he came down the escalator, as he loves to say, and talked about Mexican rapists and murderers. And there's a good kind of a companion piece to the New York Times article on NJ.com for NJ for New Jersey. And NJ.com points out the language shift was obvious a long time ago. And really, this should have been covered by corporate media long ago. The other thing the article does, just to kind of soften the audience's understanding of how serious this is the New York Times includes voices from Trump's allies who just say he's absolutely fine. And this isn't very different than when Biden staffers were saying everything's good and critical reporting would say you can't really go by that because obviously that's what they say. That's what they would say. When Biden was still in the race, the Trump cognitive decline story just wasn't really interesting to the New York Times. And to avoid just picking on the New York Times, it didn't seem like a super interesting story to corporate media in general. So like, we're using the New York Times as a prism through which to talk about this because they wrote an article. Good for them. But the truth is, I've been pointing out for 18, 24 months that the Trump brain stories are conspicuously missing from corporate media, save a couple little spits and spurts over the last few months. Even in the New York Times article, they're using much softer language. They call it Trump's cognitive change rather than cognitive decline. Change suggests he might be changing cognitively for the better. And we all know that that's very much not the case. And they are very cautious about saying something is definitively going on. So I want to try to be balanced. I'm glad the New York Times is talking about it rather than not at all. They are softening the story by not calling it decline, calling it change. They're softening the story by quoting Trump allies who say there's nothing to see here. They're mitigating the impact of the story by only starting to talk about it, just under 4 weeks before the election, around 4 weeks, I guess 4 weeks and a day before the presidential election. And they are drawing attention to it now when the political stakes have shifted dramatically. And there is, of course, a question for me as to whether this is calculated. I'm struggling to shake that feeling. But to the extent that anyone's willing to talk about it, good for them. and it's better than nothing, that's for sure.
Well, we have to agree with Mr. Pacman that it is better late than never. We certainly hope that other news media outlets besides Pacman, Micellus, Brian Tyler Cohn, and MSNBC, and a few others will take notice. And by that, we do not mean Fox News, because we're pretty sure that they're a hopeless case. Fox got irked by the New York Times editorial and sounded off on it the next day, which Pacman's also on top of.
I spoke to you yesterday about how the New York Times, they looked under a rock and they looked underneath a pillow and they checked the couch cushions and they found that Donald Trump's brain is starting to decline. They didn't have the testicular or ovarian fortitude to call it cognitive decline. Fine, they called it cognitive change. They came up with it 29 days before the election rather than years ago when we noticed it. Fine. But at least the New York Times found the story. Fox News' Brian Kilmeade doesn't like it. He's upset that the New York Times is now talking about this, and he just wants to talk about Kamala. He doesn't like the story about Trump.
To talk about Kamala Harris doing serious interviews tomorrow, Brian, she's going to be on The View, Howard Stern, and Stephen Colbert. Friendly interviews.
A lot of times she blows them too.
Right.
So anything could happen. Her prompter stopped on Friday, and she kept repeating the same 32 days four or five times. But yet the front page of the New York Times last night, and maybe it's today's, that just broke last night, is Donald Trump mentally okay? He just spoke for an hour and 45 minutes in front of maybe 60 to 100,000 people. He does three interviews a day. He's going to do a whole bunch. He's doing WABC this morning and doing a whole bunch of interviews all week. And they're like, is Donald Trump okay? Why doesn't he do a cognitive exam? You have Kamala Harris, who can't get through any type of interview and make any sense. And that's why the people that are closest to her don't want her doing any. They asked a follow-up question to what you said about lying about IVF. He goes, do you on an abortion ban? So Shannon Bream, so when he says, I'm not going to sign an abortion ban, do you think he's lying to you? He goes, yes. What are you supposed to say to that?
Right.
So lying when you disagree with the policy that'll push your campaign further. All I could tell you is the polls are a flat-footed tie, and we'll see who's going to outwork the other.
Well,
it looks like 60 Minutes is not going to get Donald Trump. But she sat down for a 60-minute interview that's not going to air till next Sunday? That's bizarre.
Now, also, contrary to Brian Kilmeade's claims of 60 to 100,000 people, it was a big rally. I told you yesterday, do not for a second think Trump has no momentum in Pennsylvania. This is a big crowd. But it was not 60 to 100,000 people. By all estimates, it was like 24, 25,000 people. And just because Trump spoke, the idea that, oh, he spoke for an hour and a half, clearly there's no brain issue. It's not just how long you can speak. Lots of people with cognitive decline will talk to you for 6 hours. That doesn't mean what they're saying makes any sense. That's what matters. The New York Times, way too late, in a way too careful, guarded way, found the story about what's going on with Trump's brain. Fox News is furious, and they should be, because if people knew what was going on with Trump's brain, I don't know that he'd have nearly as much support.
You have to admire the interjection by the stooge working for Fox News that, it looks like 60 Minutes is not going to get Trump. Well, you know, why do you suppose that is? Mr. Miller, why don't we ask 60 Minutes?
It's been a tradition for more than half a century that the major party candidates for president sit down with 60 Minutes in October. In 1968, it was Richard Nixon and Hubert Humphrey. This year, Vice President Kamala Harris and former President Donald Trump accepted our invitation. But unfortunately, last week, Trump canceled. The Trump campaign had told us that the interview would be this past Thursday at Mar-a-Lago. They also asked us whether we would meet 78-year-old Trump in Butler, Pennsylvania, where he was grazed in an assassination attempt. We agreed. On September 9th, Trump's communications director, Stephen Chung, sent a text that read, quote, I'm working with our advance team to see logistically if Butler would work in addition to the sit-down. Sit-down meaning the interview in Florida. Days later, Chung called to say, quote, "The president said yes." Then, a week ago, Trump backed out. The campaign offered shifting explanations. First, it complained that we would fact-check the interview. We fact-check every story. Later, Trump said he needed an apology for his interview in 2020. Trump claims correspondent Leslie Stahl said in that interview that Hunter Biden's controversial laptop came from Russia. She never said that. Trump has said his opponent doesn't do interviews because she can't handle them. He had previously declined another debate with Harris, so tonight may have been the largest audience for the candidates between now and Election Day. Our questions addressed the economy, immigration, reproductive rights, and the wars in the Middle East and Europe. Both campaigns understood this special would go ahead if either candidate backed out.
Yes, anyone who's been following the campaign of Trump and Vance would realize that, one thing they are not fans of is fact-checking. And unfortunately, one thing the MAGA team does not do a lot of is checking out the facts of what's being thrown in their direction. And there's been quite a bit of mischief in that regard regarding the twin hurricanes hitting Florida one after the other. Trump has been lying about FEMA's response, been lying about the government's response, and it's causing a lot of trouble and upsetting a lot of people. Here's a report from MSNBC.
These intense, even emotional warnings about the possible impact of Hurricane Milton come, of course, just a week and a half after Hurricane Helene banged into Florida's Big Bend region and then proceeded up and inland, where it caused just shockingly widespread and profound destruction in parts of Georgia and South Carolina and North Carolina and Virginia and Tennessee. And recovery efforts in those states continue. But one of the other things that people in these states are having to contend with, which is insane, is, on top of everything else, a tidal wave of disinformation and conspiracy theories designed to maximize the chaos and turn people against each other and reap whatever political points can be wrung out of it. I mean, amid everything else, here's the front page of the Winston-Salem Journal in North Carolina. Their front page, all columns above the fold headline, fighting misinformation. It's the last thing you think they'd have to be dealing with, given everything else they're dealing with. Hurricane Helene triggers misinformation surge. In Charlotte, North Carolina, here's the editorial board of the Charlotte Observer. Shame on Donald Trump for worsening North Carolina's Helene tragedy with political lies. FEMA has had to make a whole section of its website devoted to debunking false conspiracy theories and disinformation about the hurricane and the response that have been spread among other people by the Republican candidate for president of the United States. The North Carolina Department of Public Safety, again, with everything else they have to deal with, they have also had to make a fact versus rumor new website to help people sort through the trash that is being promoted for political benefit. I mean, back in reality, among people actually involved in the response, North Carolina's governor has called the federal response to Helene, quote, unprecedented. North Carolina Republican Senator Tom Tillis says he's impressed with the federal response. He says he is proud of the response effort, that they're doing a great job. A Republican state senator in North Carolina who represents Western North Carolina, he's posted a public plea, quote, friends, can I ask a small favor? Will you all help stop this conspiracy theory junk that's floating all over Facebook and the internet about the floods in Western North Carolina? Example, FEMA is stealing money from donations, body bags ordered, but government has denied, bodies not being buried, government is controlling the weather from Antarctica, government is trying to get lithium from Western North Carolina, stacks of bodies left at hospitals, and on and on and on. He says, quote, please help stop this junk. It is just a distraction to people trying to do their job. Folks, this is a catastrophic event of which this country has never known. It is the largest crisis event in the history of North Carolina. The state is working nonstop. DOT has deployed workers from all over the state. Duke Power has 10,000 workers on this. FEMA is here. The National Guard is here in large numbers. And he goes on. Even some of the most partisan actors, Florida Republican Governor Ron DeSantis, even he says his state has received all the federal help that it's asked for. But in the Trump campaign, the federal government is denying anybody any help, right? In the Trump campaign and on Elon Musk's Twitter, they have decided it's better to mess with people, turn people against each other and lie about the response and see what they can stir up and see if Trump can benefit from it. I mean, here, for example, is the 9/11 truther, self-proclaimed white advocate, conspiracy theorist who Trump brought with him to the 9/11 commemoration last month in Manhattan, quote, "The people in Appalachia should not comply with FEMA. This is a matter of survival. Do not comply with FEMA." This is what they're doing for political benefit, right? Sure, six different states coping with devastation from a hurricane less than 2 weeks ago, and another storm on the way that is so large and terrifying it is bringing meteorologists to tears. Trump campaign sees that and thinks, what better time than to mess with people? What better time is there than this? Because maybe we'll benefit from it. Maybe if people are pushed into the most extreme circumstances possible, maybe we'll benefit from things being as bad as they can possibly be. The Harris campaign just tonight has released a new ad pushing back at the lies that Trump and his campaign have been trafficking in about the hurricane response, also reminding the country that this was not exactly his strong suit while he was in the White House in charge of efforts like this. Here it is again. This ad has just come out tonight.
I worked in the Trump administration.
Never in a million years did I ever think that I'd be working in the White House with a president that didn't care about the American people.
He would suggest not giving disaster relief to states that hadn't voted for him.
I remember one time after a wildfire in California, he wouldn't send relief because it was a Democratic state. So we went as far as looking up how many votes he got in those impacted areas to show him, these are people who voted for you. This isn't normal. The job of the president is to protect Americans, regardless of politics.
If Trump's elected again, there'll be no one to stop his worst instincts. You'll have yes men help him implement Project 2025's agenda. Unchecked power, no guardrails.
They will be serving one man. I am voting for Kamala Harris because she will put the safety and security of every American first, whether they voted for her or not.
Again, that is just released tonight from the Harris campaign. In the wake of even Republican officials in multiple states affected by Hurricane Helene starting to beg Trump and his campaign to stop lying about the response, to stop spreading disinformation and conspiracy theories among people who rather desperately need real and reliable information and real help.
And that paper from North Carolina mentioned in that report with the headline, Misinformation Surge, I would take an issue with that. It's a disinformation surge. Misinformation can be an honest mistake. Disinformation is deliberately planted lies. And that is what this Trump nonsense is concerning the hurricanes and the aid rendered. As we close the program, we should note that while the term conspiracy theory is thrown around pretty liberally as regards anything that is, well, disinformation or perhaps misinformation, not all theorizing, looking at conspiracies, is incorrect, and I would say the case in point for that would be the Trump mismanagement of the COVID epidemic. Was there a conspiracy to mislead the public? Yeah, absolutely. That is not a theory, dear friends. That is pretty much a collection of cold, hard facts. We've talked about it numerous times in the past, and we probably will do so again before the election. I'm sure we will, in fact, because, again, we can't understand why it is this issue, this incredible demonstration of Trump's gross incompetence, an attempt to deal with a medical problem like he deals with political problems, which is to deny wrongdoing and fight back. Well, that approach did not bear fruit in dealing with an epidemic, because doggone it, the SARS-CoV-2 virus was just not necessarily going to conform to the story being put out by Donald Trump. And for all the reasons that Donald Trump is unfit to serve as president, something, a phrase that's been thrown around by a lot of his top former aides, for my money, that's numero uno. You know, Trump's actions kind of remind me of that great quote from H.L. Mencken, who once said that for every complex problem, there's an answer that is clear, simple, and wrong. And one final thing that we're certain that we're not wrong about is that we are out of time. This program was produced by Edward McMillan. Our thanks go to Guy for making things work at KDVS. This has been Radio Parallax. I'm Douglas Everett. We'll see you next week. And the 2 weeks after that, pre-election.